Can King Charles bring Britain and America back together again? The king was very well received in Washington this week. Meanwhile, Israel in the Middle East prepares for a divisive election. And are Israelis laying down their lives for Germany? We'll look at all of these stories and a whole lot more on today's Trumpet World.
With the spirit of 1776 in our minds, we can perhaps agree that we do not always agree, at least in the first instance. Indeed, the very principle on which your Congress was founded, no taxation without representation, was at once a fundamental disagreement between us, and at the same time a shared democratic value which you inherited from us. Ours is a partnership born out of dispute, but no less strong for it. So perhaps in this example, we can discern that our nations are in fact instinctively like-minded, a product of the common democratic, legal, and social traditions in which our governance is rooted to this day. Drawing on these values and traditions, time and again, our two countries have always found ways to come together. And by Jove, Mr. Speaker, when we have found that way to agree, what great change is brought about, not just for the benefit of our peoples, but of all peoples. Our common ideals were not only crucial for liberty and equality, they are also the foundation of our shared prosperity. The rule of law, the certainty of stable and accessible rules, an independent judiciary resolving disputes, and delivering impartial justice.
Well, those were just a few clips from King Charles's speech to Congress this week. I think it's the first time in well over a month that we're starting out this show talking about something other than the Iran war in the Middle East. And in fact, starting out with, I think, a pretty positive story. King Charles went to the United States and emphasized a lot of the positive on the legacy between the US and the UK. To tell us more about this trip and how it went, we'll go to our US correspondent, Andrew Miller.
Yeah, this is only the second time in history that a British monarch has addressed a joint session of Parliament. The first time was King Charles' mother, Queen Elizabeth, came in 1991. So this is King Charles coming in and talking to the American people. And like you said, I do think this is a pretty positive story. There's been a lot of tension and division between America and Britain of late over things like tariffs, things like the Iran war, a myriad of other issues. And I don't think anything happened this week to really solve any of those disagreements. But it was a good example of just highlighting the cultural unity between two brother nations. The king's speech, I haven't actually heard him speak much before. He's got a good sense of humor. He was pretty funny, I think, anyway. Just kind of doing like some ribbing like you'd expect between two brother nations. He's coming in and being like, he said this is a really elegant venue. He's like, huge improvement over the Boston Tea Party. And then he came in, he's like, I like the renovations Donald Trump's done to the White House. He's like, we were going for a little bit more of an open air look back in 1812 when we burnt it down. But he's like, this works too. President Trump, in a fight with NATO some time ago, had reminded Europe that he's like, well, if it wasn't for an American involvement in World War II, you'd all be speaking German. And so King Charles came back. He's like, yeah, that is true. He's like, although if it wasn't for British involvement in the French and Indian War, the Americans would all be speaking French. So it was a little bit of give and a little bit of take here. President Trump was pretty funny as well, although I think his speech did a really good job at just highlighting just the shared cultural values. I have one quote here from his speech where he says, the American patriots who pledged their lives to independence in 1776 were the heirs to a majestic inheritance. In their veins ran Anglo-Saxon courage. Their hearts beats with English faith, standing firm for what is right, good, and true. In recent years, we've often heard that America is merely an idea, but the cause of freedom did not appear in the intellectual as an intellectual invention in 1776. The American founding was the culmination of 100 years of struggle, sweat and blood, and sacrifice on both threats of the Atlantic. And so he's really highlighting the fact that, like, even the revolution that King Charles was, like, kind of poking fun with some jabs about the Boston Tea Party and the War of 1812, wasn't America trying to do something apart from English values, but actually just trying to continue on in that tradition. He had some other good quotes in there as well, just highlighting those, what he calls Anglo-Saxon cultural values. He's gotten a little bit of backlash from this, not as much as I think as he would 5 years ago. It feels, I remember, I actually wrote an article titled "Are Anglo-Saxon Values Racist?" a few years ago. After Marjorie Taylor Greene said something positive about Anglo-Saxon values, and then, like, Republicans, Democrats, the mainstream media just piled on her for saying anything positive about a white ethnic group. This time, there's been a little bit of backlash. The Atlantic published an article saying that, well, like, Trump's trying to, like, look to race and not principles, which is, if you listen to the speech, that's not what he said. He's saying that the principles that make America and Britain unique, it's the rule of law, separation of powers, English common law, all these principles the Constitution came from, were not things that the Founding Fathers just invented out of thin air at the Constitutional Convention, but were ideas that they're getting from centuries of English tradition. Thomas Jefferson, who had a great idea that unfortunately didn't get implemented, of even making the American seal, instead of being the pyramid with the eye on it. He wanted Moses leading the Israelites through the Red Sea on one side, and the Anglo-Saxon kings Hengist and Horsa, who led the Anglo-Saxon migration to England on the other side. Pointing back to this, like I said, a shared heritage that Donald Trump is really saying a lot of good things about. Things that even here, listeners to this show will find this fascinating. Even here on the in the libertarian wing of the Republican Party, there was a man, I think he's dead now, named Cleon Skousen, who wrote several books on constitutional principles. One of his most famous, titled The Making of America, that I think the National Center for Constitutional Studies still uses that as a textbook. And he has a quote in there, I didn't have time to print off and bring the exact thing with it, where he highlights the fact that the Anglo-Saxon Chronicle states that 22 generations before Alfred the Great, before Hengist and Horsa led this migration to England, the Anglo-Saxons were living in the exact area where the Bible says the lost 10 tribes of Israel were deported. And he stops just short of the point Mr. Armstrong makes in United States and Britain and Prophecy, showing that the Anglo-Saxons are literal genetic descendants from the lost 10 tribes of Israel. But he does make the point that he said there's so many similarities between English common law and Mosaic law that he describes in his book, The Making of America, that he felt that there at least needed to be some cross-pollinization of ideas between the Anglo-Saxons and the Israelites. At the time, around the year 1 BC, when both nations were living on, like, the Pontiac Steppe, north of Crimea. So really interesting. I think that book, I've read some of it. It makes some really interesting points showing here that these values Donald Trump's talking about, like rule of law and all these great things that he's causing, Anglo-Saxon values. It's like I said, it's not something the founding fathers just thought up. It's not even something Hengist and Horsa or Alfred the Great thought up. But principles going back all the way to ancient Israel and an intellectual tradition that you can kind of trace back to this area. And so, like I said, Klein Skousen, he's basically come up with this just on the fact that the laws are so similar that he felt that there had to be some cross-pollinization of ideas. Mr. Armstrong, obviously, in his book, United States and Britain and Prophecy, does a much more thorough job saying that, well, I don't even think he talks about constitutional principles much in that book. He's just using Bible scripture to show that there is there is a descent of these peoples from ancient Israel, a descent that, like I said, King Charles and Donald Trump don't understand, but they at least, compared to like past presidential administrations like Obama and Biden, do recognize that there is a common cultural heritage, there is a special relationship, there are values that many Western nations like Germany and France and Switzerland and all the constitutional republics share now that they got from America and Britain. You go back to now, like half the world follows Anglo-Saxon political values to some extent. 400 years ago, it was just America and Britain who did that. And so there at least some recognition that there is a common cultural heritage that unites these nations. And then others have taken it further, showing that that actually goes back not just to Hengist and Horsa, but all the way to Sinai.
And I think that's what was inspiring about this trip, is seeing some of that common heritage celebrated. And that inspiration, it was more than just seeing these two nations say nice things about each other and their history, though I think that is refreshing in an era where there's a lot of finger pointing and criticism and condemnation. That was inspiring, but the most inspiring part really of this visit is that common heritage that it pointed back to. And ultimately, just like you were saying, it points back to the Bible. And this is from just a few clips from a radio program that Herbert W. Armstrong gave in 1979 on this subject.
We are the wealthiest of nations. We have been the most powerful. We and the British are the same family of peoples. Together, we possess more than two-thirds of all the wealth and the developed resources of this whole world, of this whole round earth on which we live. All other nations combined have little more than a fourth of the developed wealth and resources of this world, out of this earth, between them, to divide among them. Now, amazing though it is, we have acquired nearly all of our national wealth and greatness since the year of 1800 A.D. Never in history did anything like this occur. Never before in history did any nations that were little nations as we were in the year of 1800 suddenly sprout forth and grow and develop in wealth, in riches, in power, in military power, in financial power, and in political power and prestige among the nations of the world, such as the British and the American nations have done. Never in history has there been anything like it, where nations grew to such colossal wealth, such great power. Never did any people or nation spread out and grow so rapidly and suddenly, and never did any people or nation ever grow to such magnitude of wealth. Never on the face of the earth has there been a nation of such wealth and such great power as the United States and the British have had during this century. Oh, the United States and the British Commonwealth are not ignored in biblical prophecy. The plain astounding truth is that we are mentioned more often than any other race or any other nation on the face of the earth. And yet our true identity has been hidden from many and only revealed to the very few, and that recently in the comparative modern present. The plain and simple Bible story of our ancestry, of our modern prophetic identity, is the most amazing, the most astounding, and the most fascinating and interesting story that you ever read. Is that important to you, or is it of no consequence whatsoever?
And this is something that he talks a lot more about in his book, The United States and Britain and Prophecy. But really, you just start asking some basic questions about British and American history. Why did these two countries end up dominating the world? Why are they so rich? Why are they so prosperous? It points you back to God and the Bible. It points you back that way because there are principles that these nations employed that come directly from the Bible. And then because these two nations are given blessings that were promised in the Bible. And that really is the main and the predominant reason. And that history with God is what helps make these what made these nations great. And Mr. Armstrong has a lot more to say about that in The United States and Britain in Prophecy. But also seeing this and seeing King Charles and Donald Trump get along, it reminded me of an article Mr. Flurry wrote in July 2021, talking about more, you know, that was kind of back when you had the third term of Barack Obama, really. We went to Joe Biden and some of the things going on there. And he wrote, the division between our nations is a deadly weakness. It is a weakness the radical left, and especially Barack Obama, have spent years creating and exploiting. And Barack Obama really worked to deliberately divide these nations. He opposes that heritage. He doesn't like the biblical heritage. You know, like you said, Andrew, Anglo-Saxon kind of became a dirty word because it's that heritage that was under attack. You want to divide and rule. You want to divide and weaken his opponents and have these two not stand together. So he divided them. Mr. Flurry wrote in there, people are creating and aggravating divisions within America and Britain regarding race, class, politics, and anything else they can think of. Now they are sowing divisions between these two nations. Splitting America and Britain apart from one another means they cannot help each other. And it also reminded me of a different article that he wrote when the Queen died. He had that article, The Queen's Funeral Shows the Power of the Throne, where he just talked about it. It gives us a glimpse, that funeral and the literally billions that tuned in to watch it and the hundreds of heads of state, the power, the potential for good there is there within that throne. And I think you see something else like that with King Charles and the potential that it has to unify and bring people together. And you know, what we saw this week, it's just a glimpse of that. It's not the throne living up to its full potential. And Mr. Flurry, in that earlier article, he said that many biblical prophecies show that these trends will intensify, this trend towards division. In a world this hostile, Britain and America and the Jewish nation of Israel need to stick together and turn towards God, but they're splitting from God and from each other. So really, long run, we're not expecting King Charles to fundamentally heal that divide, but you can really see the power of that throne there. And it gives you a glimpse of, well, the Bible talks about Jesus Christ returning, sitting on the throne of David, the same throne that Mr. Armstrong shows in The United States and Britain and Prophecy, has been there in Britain. And he'll use that throne to bring prosperity and to unify the world. And you got just a small glimpse of what that throne can do this week.
Yeah, that's a really good point. The British journalist Melanie Phillips has a book that I've read and really liked called Builder's Stone that goes pretty well in detail and explains how these Anglo-Saxon political values that Donald Trump's talking about really do come from the Hebrew Bible. And therefore, it isn't just America and Britain that are brother nations, but Israel, the Jewish nation of Israel in the Middle East is another brother nation that even many conservatives who like Anglo-Saxon political values are turning against today. She made an interesting point in there, though, I hadn't really thought much about before. She actually claims, and some of our American listeners might bristle at this initially, that America's lack of a monarchy is kind of its Achilles heel. But then she goes, and I guess whether you agree with that or not, she does go on to explain very well the main benefit a monarchy can have on a nation. And that's the fact that because you've got this head of state who is like the genetic descendant of the ancient kings of your people, it's a cultural unifying factor. Like, it's kind of like the head of the family showing that, like, if you don't have a monarchy, it's easy for you to get in this mindset of like, oh, we're start over again every generation. It's like, just do what's pragmatic. Don't consider your history or your heritage too much. It's a modern world, but kind of like this ancient institution that points you back to, like, just like a king has a father and a grandfather and a great grandfather, the nations have fathers and grandfathers and great grandfathers. And you do go back to this, throughout history, and seeing that, like, yes, the nation has principles of liberty and individuality and freedom, but there is still also like a unifying factor. Like, it's one people with the same ancestors that really helps unify the nation. And then, and that's really the big problem in both America and Britain today, is a lack of unity, where you've got the liberal parties in both nations completely rejecting your history and your traditions, and claiming that Anglo-Saxon values are racist and we shouldn't even honor them at all. And then even with the conservatives, increasingly you're starting to get, like, you know, like the Tucker Carlson wings of the party, who are claiming that, like, well, we shouldn't be concerned with the state of Israel, who's also part of this intellectual tradition, these Anglo-Saxon values going all the way back to Sinai, things that were brought to England either during the Christianization process, like when some of the apostles of Christ came to Britain, or even before that, when these tribes were wandering throughout the Pontiac Steppe, after the Assyrians had deported them to that region. And so that is really, like, if you want to unify your nation, like Mr. Fleury did the article about how David's throne has the potential to unify nations if they do it right. It is a time when you actually see a king working here in conjunction with the president of the United States, looking back at our common cultural heritage, the values that made both Britain and America great. It is a good way to heal. Like I said, I think we had an article up this week. It's like, can King Charles heal the special relationship? And if you wanted to do that, that is the correct approach, is to appoint people back to their history with God, and these biblical principles that have made the nation great. And towards that end, I actually think that Donald Trump's meeting with King Charles this week was a step in the right direction and a big success. Now, the big question, of course, going forward is the fact that this meeting happened going to cause anyone in America or Britain to start valuing their nation's relationship with God and the biblical values that made their country great? There might be a few, but for the most part, the few articles I've seen go up in mainstream media sources about Donald Trump's speech on their America's Anglo-Saxon heritage have been along the lines of The Atlantic, where they're being like, okay, this is a dangerous new racist idea. And so we just kind of need to, like, forget this meeting between the king and the president ever happened and move on with our lives.
Yeah, that, I think, sadly, is probably what will happen. And like I said, it's just a glimpse of the small potential. And you see how the potential for Britain's throne to do good is weakened by so much of the immorality around it. And probably the next time we have a royal story to do with the United States, it might be Prince Andrew getting hauled before Congress to do with the Epstein scandal or something like that, or it will be Meghan Markle, the Duchess of Sussex, doing or saying something. The decline of that family and its problems have meant that various members of that family have been contributing actively to the disunity between these powers. And so that's why in his new Throne of David book, Mr. Flurry has talked about the changes God's making to that throne as he prepares very actively now for the return of Jesus Christ and that throne to bring unity to the world. So I know you got one piece of good, practical, tangible news out of that, Andrew, and that was the dropping of the American tariffs on Scotch whiskey. I mean, I don't know. I kind of envision you as being more of a Kentucky bourbon drinker, but maybe something to celebrate there. But a lot of the rest of the news, it looks like, from the United States this week is kind of stories of division.
Yeah. Yeah, there's definitely... I think I've got three stories, and I think all of them have a silver lining, but they do highlight the ongoing divisions in America. One of them, and this is a positive thing, David Morins, he was a doctor who worked with Anthony Fauci during the COVID scandal, has been arrested this week for they've got email proof that he was deliberately covering up email evidence that COVID leaked from the Wuhan lab. The U.S. government was pushing the lie that COVID had natural origins. It was not bioengineered. Wuhan had nothing to do with it. America's collaboration with the Chinese Communist Party had nothing to do with it. And so the fact that he was arrested, I mean, it is another good news story showing that we are finally starting to hold at least one person to justice for what happened during the COVID pandemic. But again, on the topic of division, it's a controversial arrest with many people still very supportive of American gain of function research and our collaboration with the Chinese Communist Party our attempts to do lockdowns during COVID. So this highlights another curse of division in America, even though it's a good thing that they're actually starting to do some arrest on that now. Another story, again, a good news story that highlights division is the Supreme Court struck down as unconstitutional a new voting district they made in Louisiana that basically connected together black districts in like six different cities in a long, like skinny, snake-like 200-mile voting district that existed for no other reason than to get blacks in Shreveport and blacks in Baton Rouge into a district where they could vote against their white neighbors. And so the Supreme Court came in and like, okay, it's like, well, we're not supposed to be racist when we make voting districts. There's a law about that. And so it's like, this district was obviously made for no other reason than to actually just like link together blacks in several different cities against whites. It's like the map needs to be redrawn so that the people of Baton Rouge, no matter what color they are voting together. And the people of Shreveport, no matter what color they are voting together. It's like, make the districts to reflect the community, the realities of the community, and not trying to like link together specific races against the other ones. So another really good Supreme Court decision that even Barack Obama, who doesn't say much these days, came out strong against and is really trying to stir up a lot of like racial hatred and political resentment against the Supreme Court for a decision like this. And then one other one on the same theme where the Democrats, they teamed up to pass a resolution saying that President Trump has to remove U.S. troops further away from Cuba and can't continue the oil blockade to force regime change in communist Cuba without congressional authorization. And then the Republican Party was able to maneuver to make sure that that resolution never came to a vote. So, again, some good news is that Cuba's, it's one of like our, it's on our state sponsor of terrorism list. It's 90 miles off the U.S. coast. It's been working with Russia and China against the United States. President Trump's taking some bold action to try to defend America by using an embargo to get a more American and friendly government in here. The Democrats apparently support the Communist Party of Cuba more than they support Anglo-Saxon political values. So they're trying to stop President Trump from doing what he's doing in Cuba. And so this this Republican effort to vote down that resolution. Another good news story that, again, like the previous stories, highlights the growing political division in the United States.
Great. Well, thank you very much for that, Andrew. We didn't open with an update on the Iran war, but it is still worth having a quick look at what has changed over the last week. Are your oil prices about to come down? I think that's one of the big questions we're all answering. So we'll go down to a Middle East correspondent just to get a quick rundown on that before we get into our main Middle East story.
Yes, the price of oil doesn't seem to be going down significantly for anybody anytime soon. On April 30th, the Wall Street Journal reported that the price of oil globally reached or surpassed $123 a barrel. That's its highest level since 2022. It has dipped slightly since then, but not in any meaningful way that people are going to feel at the pumps. President Trump has indicated that although military options are considered, he doesn't plan on returning to active fighting soon, but wants to keep the blockade going for as long as possible to get Iran at the table. Iran had released its own deal plan to end the war, which saw the U.S. and Iran both opening up the Strait of Hormuz, but reserving nuclear talks as something separate down the road. President Trump has rejected that. On April 29th, he said that the whole point of this conflict in the first place was to stop Iran from getting a nuclear weapon, and they're not playing ball. But in general, while things maybe have been uncomfortable for the average consumer, they are relatively stable, at least in the Persian Gulf region.
Well, I had to have a quick check just in case we got another big announcement saying the war's off or something like that. But we're basically in the same situation we have been for several weeks. Meanwhile, though, there have been other very significant events going on in the Middle East that are not directly related to the Iran war, though they're still indirectly touching on. Could you go over those for us, please?
Yes, Israel is scheduled to have elections in October, and on Sunday, two of Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu's biggest challengers, Naftali Bennett and Yair Lapid, have agreed to join forces and merge their political parties. For longtime followers of us or any regular observers of the news, those two names might be familiar. Naftali Bennett was Prime Minister of Israel between 2021 and 2022 after he did a coalition agreement with Yair Lapid. When that coalition agreement fell apart, Lapid took over as interim Prime Minister for a period of a few months. And since then, Lapid's popularity has fallen. He's not the charismatic Israeli Obama that he tried to paint himself to be. But Bennett, who is from the right, but from the anti-Netanyahu right, from the anybody-but-Netanyahu right, has surged in popularity as Netanyahu's most likely challenger. Those two have combined forces. They've reached out an olive branch to another popular candidate, Gadi Eisenkot. He says he'll support them, but he won't actually join their party for now. But this new party, which is called Yahad, or Together in Hebrew, is basically an attempt to get every anybody but Netanyahu candidate out there, as long as they're Zionist, as long as they don't represent, like some of the Arab interest parties, destroying the state of Israel, together under one big tent, under one unified platform, and together under Bennett's leadership, under his candidacy as prime minister, they can finally top the so-called evil, tyrannical undermining of democracy that Benjamin Netanyahu has been doing since 2009. Will it work? Well, a recent poll suggested that if elections were to be held now, they may get one seat more than Netanyahu's Likud faction, even though Netanyahu's been around for a while. He and his party are still popular. But even if that's the case, all a party needs to do is get one seat more than him, and that means they're in line first to form a government with whatever wheeling and dealing they have. So they don't even necessarily need to get a majority of the vote in Israel. But again, despite this coalescing, Netanyahu, even though he's been around for a while, is still popular with many people. And so if the current trends continue down for the next several months, it could be a very tight race.
Yeah, it's easy to forget that in Israel, like how close those votes end up being. So this could be, we could have some pretty significant changes for Israel. I've met Naftali Bennett years ago. I was quite impressed with him at the time. I think this was before he was on the kind of the anti-Netanyahu bandwagon that he eventually switched over to. How different do you think this coalition would be to Netanyahu if they do end up taking power? Because Bennett, he's from the right. Ideologically, on paper, he seems pretty similar to Benjamin Netanyahu. What would change?
Well, we got a good look at that the last time those two were in power. Bennett, as you mentioned, he's not a raging communist. He does have some viewpoints that are actually pretty sound, but if I may make this assertion, I think he's also quite unprincipled. When he came into power, his previous political party had, I can't remember off the top of my head, but something like 5 or 6 seats in the Knesset. It was tiny. And Yair Lapid could only get in power if he got Bennett on his side, and he got him on his side by saying, you could be prime minister instead of me. Leading up to that in that election, Bennett said over and over again, Yair Lapid, I don't agree with any of his politics. I'm never signing a coalition agreement with him. He even brought a document he printed out that he signed on national television saying, this is my contract with the Israeli people. I am never joining Yair Lapid's government. And not only did he break that contract, but doing so with the ultimate prize dangled over him, a premiership, when the vast majority of the Israeli public never voted for Prime Minister Naftali Bennett. And when they came into power, even though Bennett was a strong conservative, you saw him beholden to a lot of Lapid's policies. When the switch happened after the coalition broke apart, Bennett was still part of the coalition, but Lapid said he wanted to start moving forward with a two-state solution and giving independence with the Palestinians. That is something that Bennett strongly personally disavows, but he still was part of the government that helped move that forward. And in this case, well, the difference between now and 2021 is back then it was just a coalition agreement between the two parties. Now they've made an actual new party. And the reason they did that was because of inspiration of something else I've talked about on this program, the recent election in Hungary, where you've had one person pop out of nowhere, create a unified opposition, me versus the other guy, in that case, Viktor Orban. And Bennett and Lapid have openly said, we want to follow the Hungarian example. We saw how they toppled their tyrant, and we want to do what they did over here in Israel to topple our tyrant. The big interesting thing, I think, of that is that Peter Magyar, the new leader in Hungary, he probably would not have been able to do what he did without strong support from the European Union and from other European countries. Whether it was the EU withholding funds from Orban's government to make Hungary poorer, essentially, than the rest of the Union, or making convenient leaks out to the media about Orban's ties with Russia. I'm not saying that all of those news stories are invalid or that there wasn't legitimate concern with the Orban government there. But as much as possible, the European government definitely was trying to subtly electioneer for this new guy. And he came in on a platform to normalize Hungary with the rest of Europe. And in a sense, he is quite beholden to Europe right now. The EU, the European political establishment, just like with Viktor Orban, despises Benjamin Netanyahu, if not more so, mainly for his policy towards the Palestinians and him being probably the single greatest force stopping a Palestinian state from taking reality. As I mentioned, Lapid already promised way back when to start the process with that. Even if you have a Bennett government with somebody at the helm who is nominally quite right-wing, not only would he be holden to people like Lapid who helped put him into this power, but if they want to follow the Hungarian example, are they going to start looking to Europe for underhanded sponsorship and propping up? Are they going to start looking for Europe to create, manufacture diplomatic crises to make Netanyahu look bad or things like that? And if that's the case, again, they want to follow the same playbook that happened in Hungary. Are they going to start being beholden to Europe now as well?
And I also briefly sort of met Benjamin Netanyahu years ago, and it was with a group of journalists, and he was pretty gruff and grumpy towards us. And that's kind of one of the things I respect the most about him. He isn't going to shift his principles to try and please other people, whether it comes to a group of journalists or whether it's pressure from the European Union or pressure from someone like Barack Obama or the United States. He has his principles and he's going to try and do his best for Israel. And he has been proven on that point. Like you point out, it's quite a different track record for Naftali Bennett. But I think bringing up Europe and the relationship that Israel has with Europe does bring us to, I think, the other story you wanted to mention. I thought this was a fascinating story from the Jerusalem Post, which reported that Israel has continued to export Arrow 3 missiles to Germany, even while Israel desperately needs those missiles themselves, or needed them, as they were under active bombardment from Iran. And Jerusalem Post did some back of the envelope maths and were looking at some times where Israel used suboptimal interceptors to conserve their stocks of Arrow 3. And you made the case that actually could some lives have been saved if Israel had used these Arrow 3 missiles and sent instead of sending them to Germany. And it's a really interesting look at a prophetically very important relationship.
Yes, Arrow 3 is Israel's main missile defense system for targets coming from beyond its borders or from beyond the Palestinian territories. Last year, Israel made its largest defense sale ever with basically exporting this system to Germany. It's the first time that they've let a third-party country have access to this kind of system. And not just selling it itself, but also because of this, exposing its own the vulnerabilities, the back-end workings of this system. Normally, countries don't do that with other countries unless if it's a really, really closely trusted ally. And as you mentioned, this transfer was happening while the Iran war was happening. But it was also happening while Germany has been criticizing, or at least in the wake of Germany criticizing Israel's war in Gaza, putting their own arm exports on Israel for some of the actions going on there. And despite all of these pressures, you could say not to do it, Israel, under Benjamin Netanyahu, still went ahead and did it. This idea of preserving Israel's relationship with Germany seems to supersede all else in this case. Now, prophetically, these two stories that I mentioned are part potentially of the same trend, and that is of Israel looking to Europe and specifically Germany for its defense and setting itself up for a double cross. There are two prophecies that come to mind. One is in Ezekiel 23, which speaks of the modern descendants of Israel, including, as Andrew mentioned, the United States and Britain. Prophetically, the U.S. and Britain are called under the name Aholah, and the state of Israel, the Jewish state, as Aholabah. These are two feminine names to picture them as two women. And God references them as, even though he founded them as nations, even though he blessed them as nations, Instead of looking to him, they turn to foreign allies for support, analogous to a love affair, really. And as far as Aholibah is concerned, it speaks of her going to the Assyrians, modern Germany, the Chaldeans, modern Italy. We have literature about that as well. The United States and Britain, a prophecy, I think, touches on that as well. Looking for these countries with intimate military dealings, with defense treaties, with military partnerships, like what we're seeing with Arrow 3 and verse 22 says that God is going to bring these nations against Aholibah, against the state of Israel, for this treachery. Another prophecy in Hosea 5:13 specifies that Israel's going to look to the Assyrian, look to Germany for dealings with its problems, like with the Palestinians. How this ties in with Bennett and Lapid, again, this is speculation on my part, it's still early days, but if they get into power, Netanyahu, he has dealings with Germany, but he has also been trying to make Israel self-sufficient in its wars. If you see a government come in that's beholden to Europe in some way, could you see this trend accelerate even further? Our free booklet by Mr. Fleury, Jerusalem and Prophecy, goes into the details of what we expect and more regarding this trend.
Well, thank you for that, Mihailo. I think that's, like I said, a tangible look at a story that we've talked about, that we've shown is building towards, and Israel taking steps towards the fulfillment of that prophecy. But to see it happening in that tangible way is very revealing. I think one of the main stories I want to bring from Europe is similar. And that is, this week we got the latest spending figures from SIPRI, the Stockholm International Peace Research Institute, where they've tracked military spending. They are kind of the go-to people for tracking a lot of that spending. And they've concluded that military spending has reached an all-time high of $2.9 trillion last year, its highest ever figure. Of all global economic output, 2.5% was spent on its military, up from 2.4% last year. As a percentage term, that's its highest level since 2009. But it points out that it's Europe that is really driving a lot of this rise. If anything, they calculated the United States' military spending as declining. That's a bit of a statistical anomaly. It's because they count American military aid given to Ukraine as part of American military spending. And so that has declined, and therefore their figure for U.S. military spending has declined. But Europe is rising massively. It's up 14% from last year. German spending grew almost 10 times faster than the global average. It's up by 24%. It's Europe's largest military spender, the world's fourth largest military spender. Other major European powers increased their spending a lot. Italy by 20%, Poland by 23%, Spain by 50%. And I mentioned US military fell by 75%. The UK's dropped, 7.5, not 75. That would be really massive. The United Kingdom's dropped by 2%. But what I think is really important about this is we've highlighted on this show a lot of occasions where Germany says it's going to do this in the future. Germany has announced, we're going to be spending this much in 2030, and we're going to make this turning point. And there have been some critics of Germany that have been writing articles kind of saying, that's easy to say. It's easy to say we're going to spend a whole lot more on our military. We'll believe it when we see some real numbers. Like, are you actually going to follow through? And, some of that is valid. Yeah, you're going to put your money where your mouth is. It is much easier to promise these things. This news story shows they are delivering. That, their military spending has jumped up by about 25%. That they are the world's fourth largest spender. That they are the biggest military spender in Europe. We're not just forecasting into the future and talking about, if current trends continue and governments have promised this and that. No, this is a story now that has happened. That they have followed through on some of those promises. There's still more to go. And maybe they won't make it every year, or there might still be some bumps ahead, but they have demonstrated some will to show this off, to continue to go forwards with this. The Telegraph had an article talking about the fact that this turnaround is taking place. They wrote, Germany's trying to shake off the traumatic memory of the 20th century and the embarrassment of the recent past by launching one of the greatest rearmament programs in peacetime history. Kind of odd phrasing there, a rearmament program. It's an unusual way to shake off traumatic memories of World War II. But they said money is no constraint on Germany's military expansion. The only limitations are recruitment, industrial capacity, and political will. They also quote a defense expert from Buckingham University. He says, German society has changed quite a bit. If you asked me 5 years ago, I would have said this isn't going to last and that this military strategy document will just disappear somewhere. But something has changed quite drastically in the last 5 years. And of course, well, we have been telling you that that change is going to happen. You could look at the front cover of our February Trumpet print edition. Decades of warning about Germany. That front cover points to our other front covers that have had that warning. And that's an article there by Trumpet executive Stephen Flurry. It's Trumpet executive editor Stephen Flurry talking about everything that we've been saying for years. And it's here and it's happening. And in many ways, it has happened. Other big stories from Europe this week do relate to this same kind of story of unity and division. We're seeing a lot of splitting apart of the NATO relationship. Friedrich Merz said that Germany was being, or that Donald Trump and America had been humiliated by Iran. Donald Trump did not like that message. So he's responded by issuing several Truth Social posts talking about pulling all of America's troops out of Germany. There's quite a lot of American troops in Germany, and Germany gets a lot of economic benefits from that. They're estimated to bring somewhere between $2 and $5 billion in spending each year in Germany. If you think about, you've got tens of thousands of troops, and they're going shopping, and they're renting homes, and they just really support the local economy in that way. And there's an estimated 60,000 to 80,000 jobs created by the presence of these troops. And that's just the economic side of these things alone, let alone the military capabilities that they bring to the table. So in the past, this has been quite the threat. Germany at the moment seems unconcerned, partly because I think they question whether Donald Trump will pull through on that. But also you do have to wonder, well, are they getting ready to, are they happy to, despite all of those benefits, just be out of, under the thumb of the United States, get those troops out of there, be more independent, be more able to break with the United States, side with Russia if they want, have that geopolitical freedom of action and that prod to defend themselves and stand up for themselves. And I think you look at those comments like those ones by Donald Trump, and it shows America has no conception or no desire to follow through on the original belief of why those troops are there, that we need to watch what's happening in Germany and to make sure that German history doesn't repeat itself. Well, we've taken for granted that that's not going to happen. So we'll threaten to withdraw the troops, and that may well happen. Or I suspect we'd see something more gradual. I suspect we'd see, say, 10,000 of those troops coming home or being redeployed to Romania or something like that. But that's another tangible, practical way that that Germany will be able to stand without America. The other story kind of goes the other way, where we saw the Archbishop of Canterbury, Sarah Mullally, visiting the Vatican this week. That was hard for the Pope. This was a bit of a tough situation. They want unity. Unity, though, with a church that has a female bishop, a female Archbishop of Canterbury. I mean, Paul says, I suffer not a woman to teach. He said that God didn't design women to hold those teaching positions. If you're a church that claims to be the Bible, you can't have female bishops. I think the Church of England has kind of, long ago said, well, we don't really believe the Bible. We'll just do what we think is right and overrule the Bible with our own opinions. And if we think it's fairer to have women bishops, we'll do that. They had that whole discussion in the 90s. The Catholic Church has held the line on this issue. There are plenty of other things that they teach, obviously, that aren't in the Bible. And their own teachers, their own scholars will say, yeah, we add to the Bible with our tradition, and it's not necessary to have all of your teachings from the Bible. That's the Catholic view. But on this issue, they've held the line. So that put it was a lot of people were watching to see, well, how would Pope Leo deal with this? But he really did put the focus on unity. I think he went as much as he could to treat Sarah Mullally as kind of a valid head of the church, a valid bishop. I mean, the Pope's treatment of and what's recognized as valid, that's a tremendously complex and picky area that I don't really want to get into. But I think he just showed her about as much favor as he could without causing scandal within the Catholic Church. And so he put a lot of effort on unity still. He said that these two churches must, quote, use every possible opportunity to proclaim Christ to the world together. And he said, it would be a scandal if we did not continue to work towards overcoming our differences, no matter how intractable they may appear. So yeah, he did make reference to the fact that, yeah, it looks like we've got some pretty big differences, a female Archbishop of Canterbury, but they want to keep working on that. And you could look at Mr. Flurry's article, Anglicans submitting to the Pope, for much more information on that. But they will do all they can to work to bring in those protesting daughters, as you see the Catholic Church rise to dominate a united Europe, this growing Holy Roman Empire. They're going to play a major role in bringing that empire together. And as part of preparing for that role, well, they're bringing in their different churches together. So watch that important story as well. Well, on this subject of different peoples, different ideas, different nations coming together and of unity, we've got another set of two nations drawing closer together for our main Asia story. And to hear about that, we'll go to our Asia correspondent, Jeremiah Jacques.
Yes, that's right. The big story that I wanted to talk about for Asia is that India is just about to receive its fourth Russian S-400 air defense system, and the fifth will follow in November. That's according to a report in the Hindustan Times published on Tuesday. And this deal between Russia and India actually dates back to 2018. That's when the two signed an agreement worth $5 billion for India to buy five of Russia's S-400 systems. And the first three had already been delivered in recent years, so the fourth and fifth this year will complete that order. But this is a cutting-edge system. The S-400 is one of the crown jewels of Russia's arsenal. It's engineered to detect, track, and obliterate a broad spectrum of aerial threats, everything from stealth aircraft and strategic bombers to incoming cruise missiles and even certain ballistic missiles. It's a highly advanced system, and India actually used this system last year during the military conflict with Pakistan. And apparently the Indians were so impressed by the performance of the S-400 that they placed an order around that time for five additional S-400 systems. So the first order of five will be completed this year, and then from there they'll be receiving five more in the years ahead. These are very significant defense deals between the Russians and Indians. And this is just one area where we can see that these two nations have drawn remarkably close in recent years. We also, of course, see that in India's steady purchases of Russian energy, which is financing so much of Russia's war on Ukraine. We also see it in political and diplomatic alignment between these two nations. And we clearly see it in deepening defense ties. Russian and Indian forces take part in joint military drills regularly, just rehearsing to make war together. And then we also see these two nations working together to cooperate on the production of certain weapons. And Russia sells India about 36% of its defense imports now, including these top-tier air defense systems. So India, very clearly, is tilting more and more toward Russia and more away from the United States. And this takes on great significance in light of what Bible prophecy says on the topic of India in the time ahead. Trumpet editor-in-chief Gerald Fleury has often written about an Asian 200 million man army that is prophesied to form in the near future. In his booklet called The Prophesied Prince of Russia, Mr. Fleury points to Revelation 16, verse 12, as evidence that this alliance will include the combined forces from several Asian nations. And then he explains a prophecy in Ezekiel 38, verse 2, showing that that shows that Russia will be the lead nation. And then verse 5 says that the peoples of Cush and Foot will also be a part of it. That's the way Young's literal translation and other Bible translations render those names in verse 5. And history shows that while some parts of Cush and Foot settled in Africa, the rest of them migrated to India. And the context here shows that this passage is referring to the modern-day Indian peoples. So with India now deepening its relationship with Russia in so many different ways, including buying more and more cutting-edge weaponry from them, we can really see the stage being set for India to take its place in this massive Russian-led Asian military alliance.
Yeah, it seems like this is a weapon system that we've not seen tested against American advanced weaponry in the same way that we have earlier versions of the weapon of the Russian weapon systems in Iran or in Venezuela. So a pretty significant upgrade for India. Has there been any blowback on the US from this? Because I know when Turkey showed interest in Russian air defense systems, then they were told, you're kind of, that's it, you can't have the F-35, we're not willing to sell that to you. America's not usually very keen on country, like they try to make it a very clear, if you're choosing a Russian air defense system, you are rejecting us as an ally or access to our top tier equipment. Has there been any kind of pushback from the United States on India here?
From what I've seen, the U.S. has been a bit quiet about this so far. Over this whole year or so of President Trump's second term, he has been easing a lot of the, if not official sanctions against Russia, at least the enforcement of those sanctions, and that includes the export of weaponry to nations like India. India, you know, we've discussed several times how it's often sort of walked the tightrope between the U.S. and Russia. It's tried to remain somewhat neutral between those two, and it has been a hindrance toward U.S.-Indian relations every time the Indians make a major weapons deal like this with Russia, especially if it's one that violates a specific sanctions package that's on Russian exports. In this particular case, I think that this is pulling the Indians further into the Russian orbit and further away from the U.S. side.
So a significant story. What else do you have for us from the Asia region?
Yes, just one other story here about Belarus. In recent years, Belarus has really been fully conquered by Russia. It was a soft takeover, a bloodless move, really, that culminated back in 2020 when Russian President Vladimir Putin helped the head of Belarus survive an uprising against him. And that made the head of Belarus fully beholden to Putin. So ever since then, Belarus has been essentially a Russian state in all but name and has done Putin's bidding in every way. And this week, we just saw a little bit more proof of that when Belarus said that it will no longer allow Russians to travel through Belarus if they've been drafted by the Russian military. So there have been quite a few Russians escaping military service by slipping across the border into Belarus, and then from there escaping to other nations. But now, Belarus is sharing a new database with Russia, and they will know which Russians have been drafted. And they'll now be detaining these men and sending them directly back to Russia so that they can be made to go try to kill some Ukrainians. So it's just another sign that Belarus is a Russian satellite state now, fully beholden to Russia, and in many ways it's functioning as a Russian state.
Well, thank you for that, Jeremiah, and thank you to all of our guests here. Thank you to Mr. Matthew Friesen for engineering and production. We've been talking a lot about division, unity, even the throne of David and Britain's royal family. So, you know, I think I'll leave you with one book recommendation we don't often mention, and that is The Key of David. The Key of David, a book that shows how God is going to use a throne to unite the world. It ties right in with, I think, a lot of what we have talked about. You can get that on our website, thetrumpet.com. We'd be very happy for you to read that online for us, or for us to send you your own free print copy. If you want to know more, if you have any questions or comments on the show, please do get in touch, trumpetworld@thetrumpet.com, or leave us a comment, like, subscribe. We'd be very happy to have you help us get the message out in that way. We will be back next week with our regular Wednesday show. Until then, keep watching your world.